Thank you. Good afternoon or good morning to those of you on the West, and welcome to the Talking Freight Seminar Series. My name is Jennifer Simone, and I'll be moderating today's seminar. Today's topic is Innovative Low-Cost Freight Transportation Collaborations, Public and Private Partnership Opportunities. Before I go any further, I do want to let those of you who are calling into the teleconference for the audio know that you do need to mute your computer speakers, or else you'll be hearing the audio over the computer as well. Today we'll give we'll have a brief introduction given by Libby Ogard of Pride Focus, followed by two presentations given by Donna Karen and Dave Christensen of the Minnesota Department of Transportation and Sunny Jones of Daltile. Libby Ogard is president of Prime Focus LLC and has over 30 years of freight operations and logistics experience with Class 1 rail carriers and at Schneider National. She recently led a freight rail economic development study in Minnesota and is the chair of the Transportation Research Board AR40 Subcommittee on State Rail Freight Planning. Donna Karen is the Market Research Director for the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Project Manager for the Manufacturer's Perspectives on Minnesota's Transportation System Project. Donna leads public opinion and market research efforts for MnDOT, bringing public input into department decision making. Donna has an almost 20-year career in Minnesota state government and a master's degree in public management and policy analysis from the Humphrey School of Public Affairs. Dave Christensen worked 25 years in the private sector as a transportation manager, including work in the oil industry, warehousing and trucking, and marine and rail intermodal, covering the Gulf Coast, Midwest, and West Coast. He also worked as a transportation consultant for a number of years. In 1999, he entered public service and transit management and freight planning and has served as a rail and freight planner for MnDOT since 2008. He served as the project manager for the Minnesota State Rail Plan and is currently involved in a number of special assignments. Sunny Jones is a bilingual logistics professional with a background in the sales, operations, and engineering disciplines of the logistics industry. His operating background and experience spans much of the Americas, having worked for numerous carriers prior to his current logistics role as a shipper. A 2008 redesign of the Daltile supply chain, which incorporated the M10 Marine Highway, resulted in Mr. Jones being presented with the Pioneer Award at the 2011 Marine Highways Conference. More recent collaborative efforts within the U.S. and Mexican freight community have driven significant improvements in cross-border capacity utilization, particularly on rail modes, fueled by the density of Daltile's ceramic tile products. This process was awarded first place at the 2012 Global Supply Chain Innovation Competition, co-sponsored by the Council of Supply Chain Management Professionals and Supply Chain Brain Magazine. In January 2014, Mr. Jones and his collaborative partners were also presented with the Alliance Award for International Freight Solutions from the SOC3 and World Trade 100. Today's seminar will last 90 minutes, with 60 minutes allocated for the presenters and the final 30 minutes for audience question and answer. If during the presentations you think of a question, please type it into the chat area. Please make sure you send your question to everyone and indicate which presenter your question is for. The presenters will not be able to answer the questions during the presentations, but I'll start off the Q&A session with the questions typed into the chat box. If we run out of time and are unable to address all questions, we'll attempt to get written responses from the presenters to the unanswered questions. The PowerPoints used during the seminar are available for download from the file download box in the lower right corner of your screen. The presentations will also be available online within the next few weeks, along with a recording and a transcript, and I'll notify all attendees once the materials are available. Talking Freight seminars are eligible for 1.5 certification maintenance credits for AICP members. In order to obtain credit for today's seminar, you must have logged in with your first and last name, or if you're attending with a group of people, type your name into the chat box. I've included more detailed instructions in the file share box on how to obtain your credits. Please note that today's webinar is not yet available on the AICP website, but I'll send out a notice once it is. For those of you who are not AICP members but would like to receive PDH credits for this webinar, please note that Federal Highway does not formally offer PDHs. However, it may be possible to receive them for your participation in Talking Freight if you are able to self-certify. To possibly receive PDHs, please download the agenda from the file download box and submit it to your respective licensing agency. Finally, I encourage everyone to download the evaluation form from the file share box and submit it to me after you've filled it out. So with that, we're going to go ahead and get started with a brief introduction from Libby Ogard of Prime Focus LLC. So Libby, I will bring up your one slide that you have. If you give me just a second here, and we can get started. So let me see here.
All right, thank you so much, Jennifer. At some point in everyone's career, you will be challenged to do more with less, whether it is working with a smaller budget or finding ways to cover all roads in a capacity-constrained environment, or possibly rethinking your current work processes due to a scarcity of resources. This has all happened before, and it will all happen again. Collaboration is an important tool to help overcome these challenges. Today, it's my pleasure to introduce two case studies which demonstrate the power of collaboration, which has produced some very innovative results. In the first case of Minnesota DOT, they undertook a bold, low-cost, qualitative outreach effort and sat down with business owners and logistics companies to better understand each other's businesses and objectives and the workflows that were important to these businesses. This collaborative process resulted in better communication and resource allocation. In the Dow Pile case study, we will examine how manufacturing collaboration worked with other neighbors in the same manufacturing community to take full advantage of both weight and cubic capacity of rail cars and containers, which achieved some stunning financial results as well as some positive impacts in terms of congestion and the environment. With that, I'll turn it over to Minnesota DOT.
All right. Thank you, Libby. So as Libby said, we're going to move on to our first presentation given by Donna Curran and Dave Christensen of the Minnesota Department of Transportation. So Dave and Donna, if you give me a second, I'm not sure if you're seeing your presentation yet. It's a little bit of lag time for me right now, so I'm just waiting for it. There it is. So you can go ahead and get started.
I got it up. Okay. Thank you, Jennifer, and thank you, Libby, for that introduction. And good afternoon, good morning to everyone who's on the call with us. Dave and I are very excited to present this model to you because it's really a very, it's a very simple model, but it was just amazingly effective in helping connect us, sort of the what appears to be the monolithic MnDOT to local, locally based manufacturers and carriers in a particular part of the state, and to really connect with them in an authentic way, to hear about their businesses, their needs, their priorities for the transportation system, and then to be able to make changes to our systems so that we can better align what we're doing with what they need, and thereby having us all help support the economic vitality of the area that we were looking at and then the state as a whole. So our project had just a few primary purposes and a pretty well-defined scope, because we didn't want to take on more than we could handle, and we certainly didn't want to promise more than we could do. So what we basically wanted to do was learn what we didn't know about manufacturers' transportation challenges and priorities. We, as other DOTs had done a lot of freight studies, and we had lots of quantifiable information about loads and trips and all of that, but what we didn't know and what we had been hearing, well, what our district engineer and his staff had been hearing somewhat through anecdotes, were about some of the challenges that we just couldn't collect through a freight study where we would send out consultants to do the data collection, but that were very important. For example, one of the anecdotes that sort of got this started and got us thinking about the need to do this was that we heard that a manufacturer was taking a very circuitous route to get to the routes that they needed to the Twin Cities because of the pavement conditions. So the most direct route had rough pavement, the more circuitous route had had smoother pavement, and that was important because they were transporting high-tech equipment that was getting damaged by taking the most direct route. And that was something that we just wouldn't know if we hadn't heard. So we thought, well, if there are a few anecdotes like that, there must be just a whole lot more, and so we wanted to collect this in an organized way. And the district engineer, John Hughesby, for this area really got that going and thought very deliberately about how we would scope that. The second purpose was to build relationships with these regional manufacturers and the carriers who serve the area, as well as economic development organizations. We wanted to do the data collection. We wanted to hear what the challenges were, what the priorities were, but we didn't want this to just stop with a point-in-time study. We actually wanted to develop ongoing relationships or reinforce ones that already existed. These all weren't totally new, but some of them were, because we wanted these manufacturers and the carriers to be able to, feel comfortable to call us when they had a problem. And we wanted to be able to contact them when we thought, we would be doing work out on the roads that could affect their ability to move their goods. We thought if the lines of communication are open and flowing, it's going to work better, in particular for the manufacturers and the carriers, but for us as well. And so we very deliberately did a lot of the project work ourselves, MnDOT staff, so that we could build those relationships for the long term. And I'll talk more about the role of the economic development staff in the region too, because that was vital to the project's success. And then in terms of the information we wanted to collect, the project scope itself, we wanted to identify the very concrete, very actionable, low-cost, high-benefit improvements that we could deliver on in 1 to 4 years. We didn't want to, talk about adding extra lanes. We didn't want to talk about lots of new investments because we don't have lots of resources to make new investments. What we're looking at are ways that where we can maybe reset some priorities, maybe reconfigure some of what we're doing, enhance some of our services that aren't necessarily infrastructure related but have more to do with maintenance and operations. So infrastructure sort of in a micro sense with regard to maintenance, but then also operations, things like snow and ice removal, how we manage communication around construction, things like that, and I'll get into some more detail in just a minute with that. And we wanted to be able to, be able to say that we could deliver on this within the next few years. We have our 20-year plan, we have our 50-year plan, but we wanted to be able to make improvements that the manufacturers and the carriers would be able to experience in roughly the near term. So our project budget, really because we did a lot of the work ourselves and that was intentional and because we relied on local economic development professionals who were volunteering their time to participate in the project, we only ended up spending $105,000, which, in terms of construction projects is obviously minute. But for a year-long project where we were going out into the district and sort of covering the entire area, doing interviews with our University of Minnesota research team, we thought it was a really good deal because we came back with hundreds of pieces of discrete, pieces of data, pieces of feedback, either about, locations on roads or, specific actionable things that we could work on from a good number of interviewees. So we thought it was a pretty good deal. We actually expanded. We started out with a smaller scope. We thought maybe we would get 40 interviews or so, and then when we sent out the invitation to manufacturers to interview, the response was so positive that we, in order to accommodate all of the requests for interview at that point, we expanded both the budget and the timeline to the 105 and pretty much year-long timeline. So this is MnDOT District 8. It's comprised of 12 counties. There actually are about 10% of Minnesota's land area. Interestingly, there are no interstates in the district itself, but there are interstates around it. So these manufacturers and carriers that are needing to get goods out of the district, are using, that infrastructure to connect to the interstates to get to either the Twin Cities or to get to bordering states and then points beyond. The district gets lots of snow. They were particularly hard hit this year. I mean, the whole state was hit hard, but it's a lot of flat area, a lot of farm area, and they struggle. Anybody who needs to travel in the district struggles with snow. That's just an ongoing challenge during this season. And since we're just hopefully coming off of this season, that was sort of uppermost in my mind too, so I put in our plow. And the district has just 7 cities with a population over 5,000. So it is a lot of smaller communities. And our district engineer was thinking, well, where there's a manufacturer in some of these small communities, it's vitally important that we're doing everything that we can as an agency to support, their being able to get their input, on time, and they're being able to get their products out, kind of on time and within budget, or at least so the transportation is facilitating that and not creating barriers to that. So, that said, given that that is the district, what we found when we actually methodically went in, and I say we, I really mean our University of Minnesota state and local policy program partners. They did an industry cluster analysis and found that we just have a wealth of manufacturing going on in the district, and it's diverse, and it's some of it's large, some of it's small. We were actually surprised. Again, we had heard a lot of this through anecdote, but when we actually, did the analysis, when our university staff did the analysis, we found that it's really amazing what's going on there, and so all the more need for this kind of a project. We have manufacturers making, high-tech equipment, medical equipment, making, huge cranes, making huge scoreboards, kind of everything from there down to large-scale food processing. It's extremely diverse. There's a lot more information about this whole process of the industry cluster analysis in our report, which is, can be available to anyone who wants. So I won't spend a whole lot of time on that, just to say that it was a fairly deliberate process to identify who we would interview, and then we took recommendations also from the local economic development organizations. Who we involved, if they knew of some companies that hadn't made our list for whatever reason, we included them as well. And so basically, we were looking for manufacturers who had kind of a competitive advantage in the area for whatever reason. We wanted to make sure that they were covered, and then again, we included others. But, what we understood through this process of identification was that, and also talking with them, was that, we have a lot of manufacturers in this area of the state who are shipping internationally. 29 of our manufacturers, as you can see, are really shipping their products around the world, which was a little bit stunning. And so, again, all the more reason to make sure that transportation is facilitating that connection to the world and bringing those resources from their customers back into the region and back into Minnesota. We have the demographics of these companies also laid out in the report as well. But again, we went for diversity. We really wanted to understand who was in the district. So I referred to the going out and doing the work ourselves, and a number of times we intentionally wanted to have MnDOT staff go out and meet with the manufacturers in the interest of having ongoing relationships with them. So we teamed our staff, both from the district and central office, with the state and local policy program staff who were administering the project for us, as well as the University of Minnesota Extension Center staff who were key in bringing in the local economic development organizations into the project. So they said that the local EDOs volunteered their time to work with us, and we would form interview teams of two or three people, and we would send them out to do these face-to-face, about hour-long qualitative interviews with the manufacturers and carriers, kind of at their place of work in the district. And it was just a terrific process. Often when MnDOT, does these kinds of projects to get information or input from our customers, and they're good projects, and I mean, I do them, we hire consultants and we say, can you go out and collect this information for us and tell us what you find. But then there's always that filter there. And we really wanted to meet with these folks face-to-face ourselves. And we think that really made a lot of difference in terms of understanding kind of really at an immediate level what it is that they're encountering, from some of the stories that that we heard from them. And then Dave will give you some examples of that later on in this presentation. We also involved we involved people throughout the project because we didn't want to come to the end of the project with a report and say, here's a report that, nobody had really been thinking about or heard of, and they weren't sure what it was, and, what is this thing on my desk that I've now got to implement. So we wanted to include kind of the larger district staff and more staff from central office in on the findings partway through the project so that they knew what we were hearing. We could start initial planning. And just so that it wouldn't be a surprise at the end of it. It's still a lot of work, it's still a lot of analysis to do and, kind of folding it into our existing plans. But we didn't want to take anyone by surprise, and we wanted to involve really all levels, or many levels, within MnDOT to, to start working with this data sooner rather than later. We met with the EDOs at the outset of the project to invite them to participate, and then provide a training session to them on how we wanted to conduct the interviews. And many of them were probably old hands at doing similar types of work, going out and meeting with manufacturers and hearing what their needs were. But we had a structured interview, and we wanted to meet them, get familiar with them, have them feel comfortable with us, and then go through the script and address any questions. So that was just a good opportunity to kind of get our different organizations together at the outset. We also met with the region city and county engineers, and the Mendocino district staff have been having regular meetings with them all along, just in general as a part of the work. But we wanted to give them a heads up on what we were hearing as well with the findings, and then also get their reactions and do some initial brainstorming or discussion of what we might do to work together more effectively, so we're again facilitating transportation and not creating any barriers that can be avoided for the manufacturers and carriers. So the qualitative interviews themselves, we went in really with a bunch of open-ended questions. We wanted to get specifics about infrastructure needs and things like shoulders and passing lanes and the quality of pavement, those sorts of infrastructure improvements that we could make, kind of at that scoping level. And then maintenance and operations, I referenced, stone ice removal and construction, but then everything else that happens as well. Communication was a big area too, and that turned out to be one of our most important themes, which I'll get into shortly in terms of what people said. The folks we interviewed had quite a few suggestions or improvements that they thought that we could do. And then just telling, and not that we're doing a bad job at all to start with, but for example, when I talk about 511, they had some improvements that maybe we hadn't thought of, those kinds of things. And then policy issues, although that didn't turn out to be kind of a huge category. But really, we just asked a lot of open-ended questions to try to understand their business, to hear what it was they needed from us, from the system, and to talk about how maybe we could better address their needs than we have been. So some major findings and themes, and our report really provides a lot more detail on these and other themes. What we collected, as I said, were kind of discrete pieces of information coming from the interviews. So we actually have our state highway map, and we pulled those out at almost all of the interviews, and we had the manufacturers or carriers mark them up with post-its, and markers, points on different roadways that were problematic for them and why. So we have, actual locations that we can take a look at and, do further analysis on. And then we had, the specific issues by manufacturer. So, as you can see from this picture, actually I think this is a carrier photo, but, so we have this oversized load, and if I'm, getting boxed in by a roundabout, that's going to be a problem because I can't get this through a roundabout. So those kinds of conversations, and then, just kind of the larger themes in general. So, one of the anecdotes that kicked the project off, this smooth pavement one, we heard that from quite a number of manufacturers. This smooth pavement is essential for transporting not only the fragile high-tech equipment, but also livestock. And so that was a new find, completely new finding for us, but very important to a number of the folks we interviewed. Some inputs and products are very time-sensitive for a number of reasons. Sometimes they're perishable. We have a dairy that is shipping milk every 3 hours around the clock, and so if they're getting boxed in either through detours or because roads are shut down because of snow conditions, they absolutely have to have alternative routes, or if they literally have spilt milk. So hearing those kinds of things. Or, a manufacturer needs to get their products to MSP, or International Airport, to get those out by a certain time, or else, they're delayed 24 hours or whatever it ended up being. But so just getting the details on all of those kinds of issues. This is an interesting finding, too, that wide shoulders are valued for safety, so that drivers want a place to pull off if they need to. that they don't have to be paved, but that they be wide is very important to them. So that was an interesting finding as well. And as I mentioned, the roundabout issue. And then we had some creative problem solving around that when we got together with the larger MnDOT staff for suggestions for problem solving. Not that we're going to implement all of this right yet, but talking about how we can address some of those issues for shippers. Safety and roadway technology. The signage is very important to this. So it's a low cost, relative to delivering the overall transportation system. It's a low cost way to get more information out to drivers, to save them, either from getting lost or just taking circuitous routes that they don't need to, that kind of thing. They said they really appreciated the flashing lights. We've got these long, stretches of highway that are just flat and they're just, going down. When they know that they're going to have to stop because they're approaching a town, that's extremely helpful for them from a safety perspective. Now, I have to say that this little sign up here, if you hit this sign, you will hit that bridge. That is not a Minnesota sign. I think our university staff pulled that from the internet, I think maybe from Georgia. But something to that effect was requested by a number of interviewees. And I think one of them suggested using maybe like a laser, so if the truck goes through and trips the laser, they get a warning that, if they're going to hit the bridge, and so not do that. But, even something as simple as this would be helpful, that they said. And it's just a funny sign. But it would never get through our sign committee. So let's see, and additional rumble strips. Just another, again, a low cost, relatively speaking, solution that was requested, which we wouldn't have known about otherwise. We learned that snow and ice removal, even given the challenges this region faces, is generally working well. But, here's where we can sort of change the priorities in some areas. So if there are time-sensitive shipments that need to go out, maybe make sure that those routes are cleared at certain times, if possible. I mean, there are so many considerations that go into that scheduling, but having that input inform that scheduling is something that we didn't have before. And so we're really grateful to have that now. I mentioned 511 earlier. This is used to a degree that we just hadn't anticipated, but we, some of our project team and interviewers went into dispatcher's offices, and they would have like 9 monitors up with 511, all of the different screens. So it looked like a little, our traffic management center, but sort of in micro form. So they use it heavily, and they, to such a degree that they recommended improvements. For example, they suggested that they be able to have their drivers do live uploads on road conditions to the system, so that we're not just depending, on our state patrol and MnDOT staff, but so that we actually have all of these professional drivers who are out on the roads uploading to the system and making it more robust. So, it's an idea that we're definitely taking a look at. They had some other suggestions as well. And then, overall, just greater coordination among the different jurisdictions so that they're not, running into detour upon detour from, counties to states as they go through the construction project or during construction season, as we like to call summer in Minnesota, so that they're not running into that to the extent that they are, again, where possible. So, there's so many factors that go into, how construction projects get scheduled at the, the city, county, and state levels. So it's not an easy thing to resolve, but to the extent that we can, make some progress on that, they would see that and they would appreciate it. So some early successes. It was interesting. Whichever interviews our district engineer went out on, he usually ended up doing some problem solving. So that was kind of neat. And of course, he couldn't do all 75, but. And we were able to follow up on some ideas that came from other staff as well. But some of the things that we did early was to provide assistance, and he went out later with his senior planning staff, and where manufacturers needed alternative routes because they were either periodically getting shut down for snow and ice or because of construction, and they really needed viable alternative routes because they had time-sensitive shipments. He and his staff in the district went to go work with them and do some problem solving around that. So that's a really good win. That sort of demonstrated kind of almost immediately, you know, that we were being responsive and that we could do this kind of problem solving with them. We also were able to solve a permitting issue, which led to a manufacturer of oversized homes actually being able to do an expansion of their facility over $1 million, because they could build now these larger homes because they would be able to ship them to other states where they hadn't been able to do that before. Let's see, we are currently incorporating these all of this discrete feedback into our district and our central office planning. It's a lot of information, a lot of really good information, and we need to sort of crosswalk it with existing plans and see where we already have things programmed and see where we could perhaps move things up and see where we can incorporate. So that's the process that's going on now. And I think because of this success that we had, and because it was, you know, relatively low cost and the staff time involved was very intentional, we wanted to make those connections. We are planning to implement this model in other districts within Minnesota. We think we can cut the time to be less than a year. There's some ways to be more efficient with the process. But really, it was a terrific project in many ways, and we're looking forward to taking it statewide, and then that, as was suggested by some of our interviewees, it should go national. So I'll turn this over to Dave now to tell you about some of the stories that we found. But if anyone obviously has any questions later about the project, please feel free to put those up.
Okay,
I'll turn it over to you, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Donna. I'll just talk about four anecdotal stories that we have from interviews that were very educational and ended up in corrective action. One of the first interviews we went out on was Pipestone Veterinary Supply in Pipestone, Minnesota. We thought, looking at this, what was our veterinary supply business doing in our manufacturer's list? But the Pulitzer analysis was proved in this arena very, very successfully. Pipestone Veterinary Supply covers a list of clients in South Dakota, central and southern Minnesota, and northern Iowa. They particularly specialize in swine production, supporting hog farms, which is one of the biggest and fastest growing industries in southwestern Minnesota. They have 18 veterinarians on staff and over 100 full-time employees, providing transportation management and supplies and medical assistance. One of the things we learned from it is that they're transporting in their large fleet of trucks, most of them being livestock trucks, from farm to farm, because the swine production chain goes from farrowing farms where the piglets are born and raised for the first few weeks to feeder farms where they're raised to full-size and finishing farms where they're getting ready for market, all within a seven-month period. That as they move these pigs over the road, they might have as many as 1,000 piglets in a single livestock truck. Rough roads that they hit, even just a few potholes can injure the pigs, make them fall, shove them alongside a truck, suffocate some of them. They also told us about detour delays, where especially in summer when it's hot, if they hit a detour and have to stop the truck, the airflow through the van stops, and pigs who have no way to perspire will again suffocate from the heat. We got it to the point of, during the discussion, getting into very morbid rural humor, where the veterinary people and the truckers were talking about Wilbur's, the famous movie pig, and they said, if you don't help us out, we're going to have dead Wilbur's as far as the eye can see, as you can see in a lot of pictures there. The other thing we found out was about FDA, Food and Drug Administration, quarantine zones. Every farm out there that has livestock on it has to have at least a half mile quarantine zone around it. We weren't aware of this. So when we plan detours and construction zones, if we cut off a non-quarantined route for pig truckers, we were essentially cutting them out of their business. That had happened several times in the past few years. We didn't have the line of communication set up, and this is one of the first things that we were able to improve on. Tevin Industries, a small manufacturer, but one that had been there for 45 years, a family business that held several manufacturing and equipment patents for farm equipment. That tiller that you see down there behind the tractor is one of their prime products. originally started with a welding crew and manufacturers over 100 people in this small town of less than 1,000 people. It should be all over the world. But their manufacturing complex had an inlet and outlet. The outlet was on a county road, right angles to State Highway 7. As the county ran out of money just a few years ago, they downgraded the weight limits on that road and effectively cut off one of two entrances to business. The one entrance off the state road was a single-lane gravel driveway over a deep-inching culvert, which effectively caused every truck coming in and out, usually about 12 a day, with overlanked equipment, over with equipment and supplies and everything else, to stop on the state highway, veer out across both lanes to make the turn, and somebody's coming out at the same time and caused a real gridlock in the middle of open country. The simple request from there, after we have everything, was just give us a permit to widen the driveway. Well, very simple. We had never talked about this before, and it was an easy fix. Friendship Homes, Donna mentioned the home manufacturer is building manufactured homes, particularly for North Dakota, the Bakken oil fields now. The competition is moving to a 14-foot wide home instead of the traditional 12-foot wide home. Friendship Homes only had oversized all the way Minnesota permits to move 12-foot wide units on these rural roads. They had made application for a wider load permit, but were afraid of pushing MnDOT because of their perception of state government and bureaucrats and everything else too hard, for fear that their permit would just be canceled and not authorized. They were holding on a plant expansion of well over $1 million and hiring well over 2,000 more people to manufacture homes until they heard about the permit. This is one that John Hitzpier, the district engineer, went out on. Before he was even off-site, he made a phone call to our permit people in St. Paul. They started processing, and within a week, the company had a letter confirming their permit and testifying to the fact that this was a permanent fix that anyone here with $1 million investment, literally within this last year. Very successful interaction. First District Association, Malcolm Food Products, an industrial-sized dairy, as well as a farming food products manufacturer, corn and soybeans, things of this sort. They produce enough milk to generate 4 semi-truckloads of milk per day, 365 days a year. They usually went to the nearby dairy about 50 miles off to process most of their milk for both cheese and milk juice. But when bad weather hit, they constantly ran into the problem going on the east-west road to the dairy of being cut off. And if, as Donna said, if the milk didn't get through, the milk literally got spilled on the ground. The cows had to be milked, had to be kept for production, but there's no way to move the milk. The tanks are very limited on the farm because of the high volumes, and it was the end of their production. Just literally lost money. We tapped our expertise from the local operations people on the highways, and where they knew where the heavy traffic was, and where the plow routes were, and the way the weather, the prevailing winds, worked on the roads, and helped them reroute the milk trucks. 5 miles longer route, but on north-south roads that generally kept clear throughout the blizzard conditions during the winter, and effectively solved their problem, also tying into the sign blowing on system and kept them in business, very much an economic benefit for this company. We talked about heavy equipment. The city of Hutchinson was one of the first places I put roundabouts in around the city, and when we heard from heavy equipment manufacturers in Hutchinson, they immediately said one thing. There are 5 roads coming into the city. You've got roundabouts on 4 of them already, and you've blocked all 3 sides of the city. We only have one way out. Put in one more roundabout, we're moving out of the state if necessary, but someplace where you get transportation. This construction season coming up, we're resetting all of our roundabouts to allow for oversized moving roads in that area, and in fact, across the state, where we put them in too tight with inside-outside curves and the like. Daktronics, they make billboards the size of what you see in football stadiums, and everything is smaller. Electronic billboards, like Donna said, if they hit rough pavement, they can destroy a $1 million billboard in a matter of a mile. Plus, they have to have height open cities on time with their shipments because it's perishable product. They were going into refrigerated containers, into distribution warehouses, and even into air freight. And ATS is one of our commercial carriers that hauls about three-quarters of the oversized and overweight loads in the state. All of our wind turbine generators, oil equipment supplies, construction material, everything else. They, again, said that, you know, get us shoulders, get us good routes. We even train our drivers on your bad roads so they know how to handle bad conditions. But we'd rather have less bad roads than better training conditions. Those are just some of the things we went into. So on the last slide on the project team, you can see we have everybody involved. We give special thanks to the economic development people and the county extension people, because every time we walked into a business, we already had a friend alongside with the team that could say, hello, how are you doing, how's your family, and really broke the ice. And that was very important that we did a qualitative, informal, very much operationally oriented interview with these people to find out what their specific low-cost and immediate needs were. That was our target. And we were extremely successful. We're carrying on with the corrections throughout this year that we need to be made. And like Donna said, we're following up with other areas in the state. So it was very low cost, very, for the most part, very low cost solutions that we came up with. So that's what we have for you. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Donna and Dave. I do want to encourage anybody, if you think of questions for Donna or Dave, please type them into the chat box and we'll get to them at the end of the seminar. We're now going to move on to our second presentation given by Sunny Jones of Deltile. So, Sunny, I'll bring up your presentation, and you can go ahead.
All right. Thank you, Jennifer and Lindy, for the opportunity to present Deltile and its partners' collaborative sustainability achievements over the past 3 or 4 years. The first thing I'm going to talk about a little bit here is to give you an overview of a couple of projects that will be presented. The first is the M10 Marine Highway. The Marine Highways are basically set up and sponsored by USDOT and the Marine Administration to provide waterway solutions that parallel the interstate highway system, with the intention of reducing highway congestion by diverting freight traffic to waterways. As the indication or the number would indicate, this M10 paralleled the Interstate Highway I-10, which runs along the Gulf Coast area. What this provided for Deltile was an opportunity to move product out of the Monterey Bay, Mexico area across to delivery into Florida and up the East Coast into the Mid-Atlantic area. Of course, the first leg was over the road. The second leg was really the barge service that ran between Texas and Florida from Port of Brownsville to Port Manatee, and then connecting with intermodal over-the-road services to provide final mile for delivery in Florida, to distribution centers in Florida or up in Baltimore. The real benefit here came from the offering of harmonized operations between Mexico and the U.S. For those of you that don't deal with Mexico or Canada on a frequent basis, we find that their transportation weight restrictions are much higher than are those in the U.S. So typically you aren't able to harmonize the load capacities whenever you're crossing borders, but in this case it really provided that opportunity and really was the benefit that was provided. The second thing I'm going to talk about today is co-load operations, primarily from Monterey, Mexico and El Paso, Texas into our distribution center locations across the country. This was really accomplished by developing strategic partnerships with other shippers, as well as a third-party logistics company, and really what we're after here is to combine opposite densities to optimize the capacity utilization, both in terms of weight and cube. So in this, we really recognize that both weight and cube are contributors to capacity, and we're really after creating transportation savings via mode shift, as well as improvements in the capacity utilization. First of all, I'll tell you a little bit about Deltile and who we are. Deltile is a subsidiary of Mohawk Industries. You probably recognize Mohawk more so in the vein of carpet manufacturer. That's where Mohawk started. It's headquartered in Calhoun, Georgia. But it also, in addition to numerous carpet brands that are underneath the Mohawk Corporation, Mohawk owns two laminate flooring companies as well as four ceramic tile brands here in the U.S. And the ceramic tile brands, since we've been focusing on the ceramic tile pieces, Dow Tile, American Oleon, Marazzi, and Runyon. Dow Tile has 10 North American manufacturing locations, 7 in the U.S. and 3 in Mexico. And really today I'm going to focus on Monterrey, Mexico as the point of our conversations. Also, it was announced about 2 weeks ago that Dow Tile will be building its 11th manufacturing facility in Dixon, Tennessee. Should be online by late 2015. And this plant will, at full capacity, will produce tile in the neighborhood of 20,000 to 25,000 truckloads per year. Tile, you know, products are very dense, typically 80 to 90 pounds a cubic foot, so our loads and all of our operations typically weigh out before they cube out, with us only utilizing about 20% of the cubic capacity of a domestic 53-foot trailer before we hit the weight constraint of around 44,000 pounds. All right, so a little bit on the state of the industry and kind of what brought us to these collaborative solutions. There's a lot of talk, and I think certainly some emerging evidence about capacity shortages. The industry purchased a lot of assets between 2007 and 10 due to the economic downturn. And, you know, what the carriers are finding today is the cost of this replacement equipment has really skyrocketed. Mission requirements are much more stringent today, and the cost of power is much higher than it was just a few years ago. We also have, in terms of human resources, you know, an aging workforce. A lot of baby boomers are retiring, and I don't know about you guys, but I haven't prepared my children to be truck drivers. It's not their career path, and probably not the career path for most of our children. So there really is a void there in terms of human resources. We've also had hours of service changes just last June. That impacted driver productivity. I think the jury's still out on what the impact overall is. Probably not quite as much as we feared, but still an impact. And really, we're at a point where the industry really needs something positive to offset all these things that are really inflationary in nature. What we've done here is really question how we as a shipper use capacity. And realizing that every conveyance and mode offers wet cubic capacity, we in the past had tended to plan around the constraints being the weight capacity versus the opportunity that existed with the unutilized cube. And really what we're doing is just questioning whether we're using capacity wisely. Okay, a little on this M10 marine highway. This really linked our production facility in Monterrey, Mexico to both Miami and Baltimore through the ports of Port of Brownsville and Port Manatee, which is in the Tampa Bay area. The really important thing here is it allowed us to harmonize weight from Mexico to Florida. And the difference here in the weight is typically 43,000, 44,000 pounds on over-the-road or intermodal solutions from Mexico into Florida versus 56,000 pounds by using overweight permitting into the Port of Brownsville and overweight permitting for delivery in Florida. This difference in the weight reduced the container count from about 1,600 a year in this lane to only 1,200 a year primarily through the increase in the weight. This produced a 45% reduction in logistics costs on our product in the manufactured in Monterrey and delivered into Florida and up the East Coast. And most of this 45% reduction came from the increase in weight, but there was also a contribution through the reduction in circuitous miles. It's a straight shot across the Gulf versus the circuity following the highway system or rail system. And it was also a favorable mode in terms of fuel efficiency. The barge traffic has a very low fuel usage. And in the end, while it wasn't really designed this way, it did reduce our overall transit time or time to deploy products by about 6 days on average. You know, in reality, what we learned here was while we increased the weight and we were really working against that weight constraint, that was what we were focused on, it really it illustrated to us the value of cube because although we had 56,000 pounds on a 40-foot container, we were only using about 35% of the cube. And so we began to look at that as an opportunity. And it really illustrated to us the need to go further in regards to capacity utilization. And the real idea was here, we haven't optimized yet. We've improved our situation with the constraint, but we really haven't optimized the utilization of the capacity yet. And another thing that we learned on this has become kind of a central theme for us is that, you know, when you buy transportation capacity, whether you know it or not, or whether you realize it or not, or whether you even care or not, you're buying both weight and cube. And if your transportation operation is constrained by either factor, either by cube or by weight, there may be value in pursuing collaborative alternatives, which I'll get into here now. So in terms of this co-load solution, the attempt here was to contact other shippers in the Monterrey, Mexico, and El Paso areas and to focus on the cubic opportunity that we had on our loads versus the weight constraint, which we had been focusing on. And to do this, we really had to develop sort of a tri-party transportation partnership by using a 3PL, a third-party logistics company, which was Transplace, to facilitate introductions to other shippers in the Monterrey and El Paso areas that might be interested in collaborative opportunities. I spent a considerable amount of time trying to get this done on my own prior to having Transplace's help, and it really made the difference having Transplace involved. Later on, we expanded their 3PL role into customs and other parts of the solution that were needed that neither ourselves or our partners really wanted to endeavor into, and Transplace provided those services. So we really had multiple objectives with this, and one was to reduce the transportation requirement across enterprises. And this is not just focused on downtown, it's about the sum total of the capacity requirement between Downtown and its collaborative partners. In doing so, we created transportation savings via both mode shifts. One of us maybe had, in most cases, our partners have had considerable rail capacity that was available to us, and we were able to shift from either intermodal or truck to rail, which was a more sustainable mode. And then, in the end, we really wanted to be sure that we had the benefits being shared properly to create a win-win-win, and what I mean win-win-win by both shippers and our 3PL, to be able to create a win for everybody. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about constraints versus opportunities and kind of clarify that for everyone. You know, capacity constraints, whether you're talking about either cube or weight, can foster paradigms about how you run your operation and how you think about capacity in general. This picture that just popped up is a picture of one of our partners' loads, and this is styrofoam cups. And if you can think about a better product combined with tile, I'd like for you to call me because this is a really low density product here, only about 2 pounds a cubic foot. So in this particular case, this load looks very well utilized in terms of a cube. They use about 97% of the cubic capacity on a private load. But then when I tell you it's only 8,000 pounds, you say, oh, wow, that's unfortunate. And, you know, if you're that shipper, it's really hard to see that there's an opportunity here because when you're filling all the cube at that well as they are, there really doesn't appear to be an opportunity here. But when you look at the converse of this, and this is a downtile load, in fact, one of the loads that supported our Marine Highways operation, 56,000 pounds, and it's only about 25% of the cubic capacity of the 53-foot trailer. So the idea here is that when you can put two types of commodities like this together that are running in the same lanes, there should be a real opportunity here. So what we saw was the barge service helped us synchronize the 26 metric ton service from Mexico to Florida. That did a great thing for us in reducing our logistics cost. It reduced our landed cost and the transit time, but it really didn't address anything that had have to do with the remaining queue. And that was the question that we started asking ourselves as we saw the improvement that we got in the M10 highway, but then began to question, okay, well, how do we get to the next step here? Now, whether you're talking about containers or intermodal containers or over-the-road trucks, it doesn't matter. This picture that you see now is actually a boxcar, and we endeavored into boxcar operations as well. This is basically a car that has 200,000 pounds of Deltel product on it. It's right up to the 205 limit for weight capacity. But you can see there's a lot of cubic capacity left. And in fact, there's as much cubic capacity untouched there as a 53-foot trailer has. So the real idea here is that if we can focus on the opportunity rather than focusing solely on the constraint, then we can probably create a situation that's much better. So focusing on the opportunity rather than the constraint leads you into a solution such as you see here now, where we have appliances combined with the tile on a rail car, and the cube is very well utilized as well as the weight, and this generates a much lower landed cost for both shippers. Another example here, this is actually the one with the styrofoam cups, and you're looking at a top view of a load diagram that we used in this solution. And these were actually, this is actually reefer equipment that we were using on a backhaul basis out of Mexico back into the U.S. And the squares that you see on the load diagram are actually Deltel pallets. This is how we loaded them at the Deltel plant in Monterrey. We dragged this load over 4 miles to the styrofoam cup manufacturer, and they filled it with the styrofoam cups, which is the picture I showed you earlier. So not only did we get very good weight utilization out of the capacity, but we utilized all the cube as well. And in fact, last year, I believe we ran about almost 1,000 loads just like this between Monterrey, with a stop in San Antonio for the cups, and then on to Dallas with the Deltel product. Another example is aluminum and fiberglass step ladders. I have to admit, when I first saw this in El Paso, I didn't immediately get it how we were going to be able to use this product to co-load with the Deltel product. But you know what? You get creative people locked up in a room for a couple hours, and you're going to come up with something. And that something was a section load co-load, where, again, this is a top view of a trailer. And what we've done is we've loaded sections of tile and then bundles of ladders, and so on, to be able to get good cube utilization as well as good weight utilization out of the load. So in this particular load, it's up about 43,000 pounds and utilizes the cube quite well. In fact, these couple of pictures here show you a couple of variations on the loading profiles. The one on the left shows extension ladders in a 3-wide bundle. They would slide a 2-wide bundle right down beside the 3-wide bundle, and again, it's very good utilization of the cube. On the right-hand picture shows step ladders being combined with the tile, it's pretty good cube utilization, as well as keeping the load weights up at 43,000 pounds. This particular project with the ladders ran from El Paso to Edison, New Jersey. So it's a fairly long length of haul, and reduced the need for a lot of capacity. And this happens to be an intermodal solution on this particular project. All right, so I mean, showing the pictures and everything is nice. It all makes it look really easy, but there are challenges, and some of these challenges involve things like, you know, developing maintenance of the partnerships. I spent a long time trying to develop these partnerships and get the first opportunity to prove the concept, And until we engaged Transplace, we never got that done. So the first hurdle is finding partners that are like-minded relative to collaboration. Another thing is you have to evaluate what risk this brings, collaboration brings into your supply chain. As well, you have to think about how well are you going to be able to synchronize services between two manufacturers in terms of volume, velocity, and all the things that go on with customer demand. There's also the issues of liabilities around rehandling, and in the case of the ladders and also the appliances, all of the Valtile product is rehandled at our partner's facility, so there are liabilities for damage that are assumed by our partners in the rehandling process. Then you have to, apart from feeling like you have products that combine well from a density perspective, you've got to have a solution design, and you've got to be able to execute it. And we did all this stuff in-house with the three of us working together. Then lastly, there's certainly some animated conversations regards to benefit sharing and how everybody gets their fair share. And I think we've got some approaches now that help eliminate the discussion about benefit sharing, because I think we have a pretty fair process that we're using today. In the end, every one of these solutions, the participants have to determine, is the view worth the climb? And I'll tell you, in most of these situations, it takes 6 to 9 months of working together before we really have an operation ramped up. Need for transparency. I think it's awfully difficult to have collaborative solutions without transparency. I think without the transparency, the collaborative solutions just don't have a strong foundation. So this transparency is really the basis for building trust and understanding that each partner is getting his fair share of the identified benefits. Lastly, I want to just cover some of the critical events that we had to deal with as we had our built and successful process here. The first thing was we really had to change our focus from focusing on constraints being the weight from our perspective to the opportunity being the unutilized cube. Another thing was we had to accept the need for a facilitator. I spent 6 to 8 months trying to build these relationships with shippers in Mexico, many of them subsidiaries of U.S. National companies, but really didn't get any traction until we engaged Transplace, who was a respected 3PL, and could open the doors that we needed to open to be able to talk to people about collaboration. And then, actually, our first attempt at collaboration didn't come away as a success. We attempted to engage a toy manufacturer in the Monterey area, and everything looked like it was the perfect scenario. And we spent probably 6 months working on load designs and operations and processes, and eventually got to the point that we all decided it was time to stay humble. We just weren't going to get anywhere. And as a result of that, Transplace and myself sat down and did kind of a post-mortem on why didn't this end successfully. And as a result of that, we came out with a list of ingredients, really about 5 things, as we evaluated potential partners that we had to have strong connection on. And those 5 things are the items that guide us forward into 7 partnerships now with other shippers. I think we've done a great job with designing and implementing the collaborative solutions. Each one of these things is a custom solution for each scenario, and I think we've certainly gotten wiser as we've gone on and how to approach these things. And then we've created an attractive benefit sharing process. Our basis here is that if you're sharing in the capacity of the conveyance equally, you should share equally in the benefits. And that's really our driving force in determining how benefits should be shared. And then lastly, we've executed well. We've had a lot of challenges to overcome, but quit was never an alternative. this is a very important strategy for us and for our partners. In fact, in 2012-13, we did about 4,000 collaborative shipments, and with a net benefit of about $800 per shipment. At the end of this year, our goal is to be at about a $4 million benefits run rate on an annual basis. And we feel there's probably about $6 million of opportunity within our network to do these types of projects. So with that, that's really all I have, and be glad to take any questions as we have time.
All right. Well, thank you, Sonny. I think we'll start off the question and answer session, Sonny, with some questions for you since you just finished up while it's fresh in everybody's mind. So we have, from Thomas Noyes, quite a few questions. I'm going to break this up a little bit and start with, on the joint boxcar shipments, Daltile and Appliances, how did you coordinate the delivery schedules of two different products?
Okay, in the case of the boxcar loads, those loads move into our partner's distribution location. Where both products are unloaded, and then so really only one product, the downtown product, has to be removed from that location and taken to our distribution location in the immediate area. So those were it's really only a movement of one product, and we typically use our own fleet for most of those services.
All right, and then how did the scheduled delivery by rail boxcar compare to either truck or barge?
Well, in all cases, we are trying to take on, I guess you would call it slower modes of transit. Those are typically less expensive modes of transit and are more fuel efficient, more sustainable modes of transit. So through our inventory and freight deployment system, we recognize products that have weeks on hand of inventory that allow us to use slower modes of traffic. So if something requires truck service, it still goes truck. But if there's enough weeks on hand, let's say 4 or 5 weeks of inventory on hand, then we know that we can put that product on either barge or boxcar service, which would provide a lower cost and not do any damage from an inventory basis.
All right. And then we have, we had somebody say that you refer to 205-pound limit for rail, and he said the limit is 263,000 minimum. And then to expand on that, is the difference between the 205,000 boxcar weight and the 263,000 figure the tare weight, the empty weight of the boxcar, or are loaded boxcars typically lower than the 263,000 load limit?
I think the 263 includes the tare weight of the car. That's probably the gross weight of the car. And the 205 to 210 is typically where you are with a high-capacity boxcar. A lot of boxcars are down around, if you get into the 50-foot variety, they're down in the 145,000, 150,000 load weight capability. And then as you get into the 60s, they're typically around 175, except for the high-capacity cars, which are just a little over 200.
All right, thank you. Okay, well, we're going to move up to some questions for Donna and Dave now, but if you continue to think of questions for Sonny, please type them in and we can move back to them. So let's see, Donna and Dave, we had for you, let's see here. I knew I saw one. How did MnDOT and University of Minnesota and manufacturers handle privacy and confidentiality concerns regarding competition, or was this not a concern?
No, actually, that was very much an issue that we discussed. MnDOT, fortunately, or somebody, it was great that somebody thought of this ahead of time. We have a provision in our Data Practices Act, which says that we can keep interview data confidential and private. So the specific, when I was talking about discrete pieces of data that are tied to specific manufacturers and carriers, that's considered private data. So we'll use that internally as MnDOT staff. And then the public report talks much more in terms of themes and, you know, provides some specifics, but it doesn't tie the specifics to specific manufacturers or carriers. So that's the way we handle that. And then we could offer that confidentiality to the folks that we interviewed.
Great. Thank you. The next question for you, were economic impacts estimated for the problems or solutions identified in the pilot study?
Oh, that's a great question. No, it's the short But that would be a really great companion piece. We didn't want to, we wanted to keep the main focus on, you know, what are the problems that you're running into, and then think about what we can do to try to address those. Of course, they have, the manufacturers and carriers know what they're experiencing with, you know, regard to you know, loss and damage and that sort of thing. But we didn't ask them for that information, one, because we didn't, you know, want to divert the conversation. Two, we didn't want to get into areas that they might consider sensitive. But on the other end, you know, if we can, as we think about the different changes that we're going to make, if we can somehow, you know, if we can quantify that in terms of, you know, some sort of return on investment, that would be a neat, that would be a neat piece of analysis to do. You know, and of course we do those kinds of things for larger projects. For this, I think we were just thinking, you know, what's the problem? What can we do to address it? And then, you know, cost will factor into that, but it wasn't sort of the primary consideration. But I like the idea, and definitely we'll give that some thought.
All right, thank you. Let's see, I don't have any other questions. We did have a comment, though, just a you know, a note that Mohawk Industries, which is Deltail's parent company, is an EPA Smartway Transport Program shipper partner, and Transplace is a Smartway Logistics partner, and this is just the sort of collaboration and logistical ingenuity that Smartway fosters, and there's a link there that Abby provided for more information. Let's see, well, we have a few minutes left, so I want to see, make sure we, you know, cover everybody's questions. We'll see if anybody does want to ask a question over the phone, so if the operator could give instructions to see if anybody does have any questions over the phone.
If you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad.
All right, thank you. Well, I don't see any other questions typed in either, so we'll go ahead and end a little bit early, but if you do think of a question while I'm just reading the closing here, please continue to type it in, and we'll go back to that. I do want to thank all of our presenters for presenting at today's seminar. I also want to thank everybody in attendance. The recording and the presentations will be available online within the next few weeks, and I'll send out an email once they are available. I will also send out an email once this webinar is available for AICPCM. The next seminar will be held on April 16th, and we're still working on the topic, but more information will be sent, as well as a link to register as soon as it's available. I'll send out a notice through the Freight Planning Listserv once it's available, and the listserv is the primary way that we share the registration information about Talking Freight. It's also used just to share any kind of freight information in general. We have close to 1,000 members, so if you're not haven't signed up already for the listserv, I do encourage you to join it and become part of a bigger freight community. With that, I don't see any other questions, so we'll go ahead and close out. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.